So last weekend, as you know, we were celebrating Easter. And it's this monumental moment in the Christian calendar, this moment when everything in the universe changed. And God is revealed to be a God who died for sinners, who was tortured and suffered for our forgiveness. And ultimately, a God who rose from the dead, conquering sin, death, and the devil. And Easter marks that the new kingdom is here, that heaven has broken in, that God's kingdom is being established on earth. But then what? The Easter bunnies have been put away for another year. The mini eggs are no longer on the supermarket shelf. And so the question is, what does Easter mean for us now? We live in this time of recreation, the now and not yet of the inbroken kingdom. We live in the shadow of the cross by the light of the resurrection. And today I want to spend a little bit of time looking at what it means to do that. The theologian N.T. Wright said this: "Left to ourselves, we lapse into a kind of collusion with entropy, acquiescing in the general belief that things may be getting worse, but that there's nothing much we can do about them. And we are wrong. Our task in the present is to live as resurrection people in between Easter and the final day, with our Christian life, corporate and individual, in both worship and mission, as a sign of the first and a foretaste of the second. Our task is to live as resurrection people in between Easter and the final day in this recreation moment." And if you were around at the end, towards the end of last year, we were doing this series on miracles. And during that series, we were looking at different stories from the Bible, moments when miraculous things happened, amazing, mind-blowing healings took place. And it was a really powerful time in our community. And we saw some amazing miracles happen, some really profound moments of healing. And we need to keep celebrating what God is doing, because it feels like something changed in that moment. And we're still hearing stories. We're still getting stories from that series, from the weekend together a few weeks ago, moments when people met with God, when heaven breaks in and something shifts. And sometimes it's really big, sometimes it's really small, and oftentimes it's a journey. We see glimpses of it. We see elements of healing. We see bits of things come to right, but we don't see the fullness of it. But the arc of redemption, this direction of travel that we're on, is towards full and total healing, all things made new. And we live in the hope of that truth, seeing moments of it. So we're going to look at John chapter 20 today. And in John 20, we see moments of encounter between the risen Christ and his disciples. And the chapter as a whole has this amazing narrative arc in it. It starts with these words: "Early on the first day of the week, while it was still dark." And John is purposefully, he's using his words with real intention here. He's marking the end of one era and the beginning of another. He's marking that a story of a new creation has begun, the first breathings of light. As the light dawns, this new creation breaks in. The old is gone, the new is here. And in the chapter, what we find is we see the disciples there, they find the empty tomb, we have Mary seeing Jesus in the garden, and then we have a moment towards in the second half of the chapter when Jesus comes to all of his disciples. And we're going to pick it up from verse 19, where it says, "On the evening of that first day of the week, when the disciples were together with the doors locked for fear of the Jewish leaders." So just imagine it, if you will, what these disciples are going through at this moment. They have walked away from everything. At some point a few years ago, whether they were fishermen or tax collectors, they gave up everything. They walked away from their lives, from their families, from their homes to follow this man. And as they followed him, they saw him do all these amazing things, these healings, say all these incredible things. And then they get to the week before Easter, and you've got the entrance into Jerusalem. You've got the washing of feet in the Last Supper, the Garden of Gethsemane, and then the torture and agony of Good Friday. And in we get to this day, and in the morning they've had these confused reports. The tomb is empty, Mary's seen Jesus, but no one really knows what's going on. And they are gathered in this room. they are in confusion and disappointment. Maybe they're angry. Maybe they're hurting. They're broken. They're not sure what they're going to do next. As they watch Jesus die, all the hope that they put in him, all the trust, all the faith seem to drain away. And they're afraid. They're locked behind closed doors. And it is into the mess of this moment that Jesus breaks in. It says, Jesus came and stood among them and said, peace be with you. And after he said this, he showed them his hands and side. The disciples were overjoyed when they saw the Lord. Again, Jesus said, peace be with you. As the Father has sent me, I am sending you. And with that, he breathed on them and said, receive the Holy Spirit. If you forgive anyone's sins, their sins are forgiven. If you do not forgive them, they are not forgiven. And into the mess of their moment, into the confusion and pain of that day, the disciples literally at rock bottom, hiding behind this locked door, Jesus breaks in. And the promise of this story, the invitation for us today, is to know that there is no door that can be locked. There is no place of pain. There is no rock bottom that is so far away from Jesus' love that his resurrection power can't break in. A number of years ago, I was not in a particularly good place. And a few people would have known this because I was really great at hiding it. But I was heading towards my own rock bottom. And when I was preparing this talk, I saw this meme on Instagram, which is an accurate representation of me at the time. It says, for those who can't read it, it's a picture of a cactus door handle. Therapist, you need to let people in. Me, it's not locked. I was fiercely defended. I was independent and self-sufficient until I hit a crisis point. And I knew that I was only going one way further down. I needed help, but that was going to be hard. See cactus door handle. And so I don't know what your equivalent moment might be. Maybe there is a mental health crisis going on in your life right now. Maybe there is a physical health crisis. Maybe there's problems of addiction. Maybe you're facing the grief of a loved one, the end of a relationship, a marriage in trouble, a place of pain and disappointment that you are trapped in. The doors are firmly locked and there's no breaking in. But the promise of this story today is that there is no locked door in our life that can keep out the resurrection power of Jesus. And in my crisis moment, when I had nothing left, there was still this flicker of faith. In that season, I never stopped believing that God was real. I wasn't entirely convinced that he was good or loving, but that he wouldn't just let me down and disappoint me. But I didn't stop believing that he was real. And there's something in that flicker that's all that we need, that mustard seed of faith that reaches out to God in the midst of that confusion and desperation and says, come in. And it takes bravery, it takes time, this rebuilding. And I do feel like there might be a few people in this room who walk in today, and there were some of the echoes of it in some of the words from earlier, but who walked in today and you are in or heading towards your own rock bottom. And there's some particular things, and we're going to come back to this later and pray about it, but I just want to pause on it because the word that I have around it is that there's no shame in this. This is not condemnation and shame. This is invitation to say that there is no place in your heart that Jesus can't reach. So the story in John 20 goes on. Now Thomas, also known as Didymus, one of the 12, was not with the disciples when Jesus came. So the other disciples told him, we have seen the Lord. But he said to them, unless I see the nail marks in his hand and put my finger where the nails were and put my hand into his side, I will not believe. A week later, his disciples were in the house again and Thomas was with them. Though the doors were locked, Jesus came and stood among them and said, peace be with you. Then he said to Thomas, put your finger here, see my hands. Reach out your hand and put it into my side. Stop doubting and believe. Thomas said to him, my Lord and my God. Then Jesus told him, because you have seen me, you have believed. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed. I always feel a little bit sorry for Thomas at this point in the story. You've got to remember that the previous week, the disciples had exactly the same information that Thomas has at this point. The other disciples had told him the tomb was empty. Mary had said she'd seen Jesus. They were all still carrying behind a locked door. I'm quite defensive of Thomas because I think I find myself in him. there was something going on for Thomas that was that he needed something. He was looking for something. There was a level of disappointment, anger, confusion, something that he couldn't let go of. He couldn't release his hands of it. He had to actually stretch out his hand to Jesus. But see the extraordinary grace of Jesus towards Thomas. Jesus isn't mad at Thomas. He isn't trying to rush him. He isn't saying, just be better. He meets him where he is with the faith that he has got and reveals himself to him. And there is no expectation of a fake it till you make it kind of faith here, just an invitation to honesty and intimacy. And one place in life that I discovered that you really can't fake it till you make it is up a mountain on your first ski trip. So a little bit of context for you. I didn't grow up skiing. Another Instagram meme for you, not on the screen, but you might have seen them around. There's lots of these memes where it's like spot the person who was born skiing and the one who married into it. I didn't marry into it, but I was kind of adopted into it. When I was in my mid-20s, I was living with a family who invited me onto their family holiday, ski holiday with Oak Hall. If you know, you know. And before we went, I had some lessons at an indoor kind of snow, fake real snow dome thing. And I wasn't bad. Like, I was doing okay. My technique was actually pretty good, but I had no confidence. And there is something, the safety of being inside a building with walls when you're on a snow slope is remarkable. But fast forward to the holiday. It's in Austria. It's Christmas. It is packed. I mean, there are so many people everywhere. It was terrible snow, mostly just ice. And if you know skiing at all, you'll know that there are green runs. They're sort of nursery baby runs. There are blue runs, which are like intermediate. You can kind of do it, but not very well. There are red runs that are like proper intermediate. And then their advanced black runs. And I had no idea what to expect. I don't think I'd ever even been on a mountain in the snow at that point. My friend takes me out on my very first morning, and she takes me to the top of a red run, a steep, busy red run. And I'm stood at the top, and everything looks a lot steeper when there's no walls around you as well. And I looked down at all these people, and I just thought, I am tapping out. Like, I can't do it. I can't do it. And as I embarrassingly sled my way through that down that mountain, I had the worst morning. And insult to injury is that that afternoon, I was put in a class, and then I was demoted from my ski class. It's the first and last time I've been demoted, and I cried myself to sleep that night. And I know, thanks. And it was horrendous. But fast forward, and over the years, I'd lived in the States for a while. I'd done a little bit of skiing the odd day here or there, and I'm passable at best. And this year, a few months ago, I went skiing again with the same friend, which means forgiveness is possible. And I, as we went on holiday, I was like, I do not want a repeat of that. I don't want to be made to feel that way again. I don't want to be so far out of my comfort zone that I'm a liberty to myself, a risk to myself. And I didn't want to, I wanted to have fun. I wanted to go at my own pace. I wanted to stay on the blues. And over the course of the week, I did do some reds. Some went better than others. Some went disastrously. But I always like to say, have you been skiing unless you cried on the side of a mountain? No, is the answer. But I had a good week. Another time I'll tell you the story of how I got stuck on the wrong side of the mountain when they closed the slopes for an avalanche. But that's a less positive story. This is a positive story. What I learned was, and it had taken me until I was 40 to learn this, but what I learned was you just got to be where you are. Like, there is no point in faking it until you make it. There is no point in pretending to be something or someone that you're not. You cannot fake it till you make it on a ski slope. And you can't fake it till you make it in front of Jesus. And that's what this moment between Thomas and Jesus is all about. This is Thomas coming in all of his realness, in this very human moment, and finding a God who doesn't condemn him, who doesn't tell him just to be better at skiing, who doesn't tell him, doesn't get angry and frustrated. Instead, Jesus says to him, okay, I see you. I know what you need. I get your fear and disappointment, and I'm with you in the confusion and doubt. Peace be with you. Jesus meets us where we are. And in the midst of this sort of miracle, mind-bending truth of the resurrection, it feels like a really human moment. Here is this human Thomas meeting a body in Jesus that is bearing the scars of our forgiveness. A resurrected body that bears the wounds in his side and the marks on his hands. And the invitation for all of us is to come before the cross, bringing all of us, not trying to fake it, not trying to be what we're not, but to bring all of the confusion, the pain, the disappointment, the doubt, bring all of it, and in exchange to receive that gift of peace. And the word peace is really important here. The actual word in Greek is this one, eirene. And in ancient Greek culture at the time, the word peace was mostly a political term. It was used to talk about the end of a conflict, the state of a country when it was in the economic prosperity. But in the New Testament, this word takes on a whole different meaning. And it is the Greek translation of the Hebrew word shalom. So it's about a peace that's not just the cessation of hostilities, but it's about wholeness and the fullness of life. It's holistic and encompasses all elements of life. And really crucially in the New Testament, this is a peace that has its source in God. So when Jesus stands in front of his disciples, what he's saying is this is the type of peace that marks out the new creation. This peace, this wholeness, this shalom, this fulfillment, this abundant life, this is what will mark out the new creation. I remember once visiting the ruins of a building after there'd been a violent conflict, and the fighting was over, and in the intervening months, plants had started to grow up between the cracks in the rubble. And it's that kind of image that Jesus is meaning when he says, peace be with you. The disciples are still in the ruins. Everything has come crashing down around them. All they can see is devastation, the end of something. And when Jesus appears amongst them, it's the start of new life. It's the start of new growth, this new creation beginning to take root in the rubble. Anyone here from Coventry? No, I thought I'd ask, you never know. If you know anything about Coventry, you'll know that it was bombed really heavily during the Second World War. And the worst raid was on 14th of November 1940. During that raid, the cathedral, St. Michael's Cathedral, right in the heart of Coventry, was bombed. And the next day, there's the provost, which is the guy who was in charge of the cathedral during the war, Dick Howard. He goes and he inspects the ruins of the cathedral. And in that moment, he makes a commitment. And he says, we're going to rebuild not to seek revenge, but to strive for forgiveness and ultimately reconciliation. And this decision was made in that moment, that very day, to rebuild in hope and not defiance. And so rebuilding would become not an act of revenge, it wouldn't be about defiance, but it would become this symbol of faith, hope, and trust. And in the days immediately after the bombing, two symbols emerged from within the ruins. There were two medieval roof beams that had fallen in the shape of a cross. And the cathedral stonemason took them, he saw them, he bound them together, and he stood them up in the ruins. And later on, they were placed on the altar in the rubble with the words, Father, forgive, inscribed on the wall next to them. And at the same time, another priest from the town found three medieval roof nails in the ruins, and he formed them into a cross. And it became known as the Cross of Nails. This guy on the top right, that is Provost Dick Howard, on Christmas Day 1940, when he conducts a service in the ruins of the cathedral, and it's broadcast across the country by the BBC. And he spoke in it of a Christian vision of reconciliation and forgiveness. And in the process of rebuilding, this new vision was cast. The community of the Cross of Nails began just in days after the end of the war in partnership with key cities in Germany that had also been bombed heavily. And it still continues today. It's in nearly, more than half the countries of the world, and it focuses on peace and reconciliation work. And you can buy little crosses of nails as sort of emblems and symbols of this vision that this provost had while standing in the ruins. He saw something of the future of hope and reconciliation. And this is the cathedral today. When the architect rebuilt it, he purposefully left the ruins up. And in fact, you have to go through the cathedral in order to enter you have to go through the ruins to enter the new bit of the cathedral. And they're an intentional symbol of peace building, of forgiveness, of reconciliation, of something beautiful coming out of catastrophe. And that's what we see in the resurrection. That's what's happening when Jesus stands in front of his disciples. He's saying, all you might be able to see is the wreckage around you. All you might be able to see is ruins and rubble. All you might see is devastation. But in the midst of it, something beautiful is emerging. This is the peace that Jesus is talking about. And in Ephesians, Paul writes about, he writes that the same power that rose Christ from the dead is the power that is at work in you for your healing and forgiveness and redemption. And that's the invitation today, to come before Jesus, to bring all that we are before Jesus, to know that there is no wall that is locked so much that Jesus can't break through, that there is no part of our brokenness, there is no part of the devastation around us that he can't rebuild something beautiful. The same power that rose Christ from the dead is at work in you. The resurrection, this story, this invitation between Jesus and his disciples, Jesus and Thomas, is to receive the Holy Spirit, and in the receiving of the Spirit, to be empowered to know that peace. When Jesus stands in front of his disciples, he says, receive the Holy Spirit. And there's two things that are happening in that moment. One, it reminds us that peace comes as a gift. But the other thing is, it's a commissioning moment. So this passage also reminds us and connects us with the commissioning moments that Jesus and his disciples after he rose again. Matthew 28, the early part of Acts. What Jesus is saying is, this thing that I am freely giving to you, now you take and freely give to others. This peace that you have experienced, this holistic, life-altering peace that you have known, now take it to others. Take it out into the world. Take it to your friends and neighbours, to our city, to our country. Because the call for all of us is to be part of rebuilding something in the midst of the ruins.